there's a bright future for the property market overall. And I just couldn't see myself doing anything else.
Today, we have another property episode here. Chris Newman from Newmill Developments.
When you finished that first deal, was there any of those tough conversations with the missus saying, I don't think this, we should keep doing this?
Chris Newman is the director of Newmill Developments, a boutique property company creating high-quality homes and projects across southeast Queensland.
With a background in health and safety, he brings passion, integrity, and a commitment to excellence to every development.
We've learned some pretty tough lessons in the last 2 years. Yes, we've got ambitions to grow our business and do bigger projects, but first it needs to come back right to a fundamental perspective in terms of who do we align ourselves, who do we want to work with.
Off camera, we're talking about the $50 million worth of developments that you're doing at the moment. How did you find the deal? Where did you find the deal?
I love the smile.
What's an all?
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today we have another property episode here with Carson, Shannon, and a special guest here, Chris Newman from Newmill Developments. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, mate. Very good. I love these property podcasts. I'm a property guy myself, for those of you guys that don't know. So when someone comes on like yourself, who's a seasoned, I'll call you a seasoned veteran in residential development, even though you might think otherwise. It's great to have you on. And for those of you guys that don't know, that have been living under a rock or first-time viewers of the Unemployable Podcast, we've got Carson and we've got Shannon. Two absolute legends. 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. And 4 years later, they've accumulated over $100 million worth of land deals and over 170 lots of land. And they're on, and it's just ongoing. They're absolute weapons. And we keep doing these property podcasts to give you guys as much information as possible, because I know there'll be a lot of people that'll be sitting there going, how have they done it? Or how has Chris done it? Because he's not a seasoned developer for many, many, many years. It's something that he's fallen into. And we're going to hear about that whole story today. Now, just to frame Chris up a little bit, Chris has done and his business partner have done 7 projects. Right now, they've got 2 projects with a GRV. Now, a GRV means a gross realized value, right, of these projects of about $50 million. And these projects are in Burleigh Heads and Coolangatta here on the Gold Coast. And we're going to unpack a little bit about his history, Newmill Developments history, how he got into development, and kind of the nitty gritty on how he's doing these developments. How is he funding these developments? How is he finding builders? How to do JVs? How to raise money? All these things that you guys are going to be wanting to hear. So again, thank you very much, Chris, for coming on. And tell us a little bit about your background, because I know that you haven't been in property your entire life. And how did you come into property development?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm definitely don't have a construction or trade background. I started in health and exercise science, studied that at university, did a number of years in public health and then corporate health, found myself in a health and safety role. And I did that up until about 2.5-3 years ago. So I guess it's all been self-led, self-driven. I've self-educated myself for probably the best part of, 10 to 15 years all around property. So I guess I don't have the skills that some of you guys in the room may have, in terms of that trade knowledge, especially yourself, Shannon. But a lot of self-education, it sort of got me to this point, and I started small. So renovated my own house, sort of got the used to managing trades, managing a budget, how things sort of come together. And then in 2019, a good friend of mine, we decided to put together a company. And we, at the time, we said, look, we'll do one single house build. We'll see how that goes. If it goes well, we might look at the second. If it doesn't go so well, we might put the queue in the rack and call it a day. And that's where it all started. So that was back in 2019, was sort of, doing that as a bit of a side hustle while sort of working full time, did that for the best part of 3.5-4 years. It was always pretty tough going. And, in 2022, we're able to sort of step away from our full-time jobs and go all in on property development.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, I love hearing those background stories, because when I used to think of property developers, I usually think of people that have come from a rich family, or they're a son of a rich property developer that have, you know, taken over the business. Because property development has the stigma around it going like, you need to be wealthy to be a property developer. And that's not the case, right? Like, as you can see in Carson and Shannon's case, it's not like they came from a lot of wealth, and it sounds like you the same, right? You guys had jobs, and even myself, right? Mm-hmm. And this gives people hope, right? And this is why we love doing these podcasts, so we can unpack these humble experiences. But the reality is this, is you took action, right? You started with one house. You didn't start with four units. You didn't start with a duplex. You didn't start with multiple, you know, residential properties. You started with one house. Now, I'm sure you guys worked a lot in regards to even the expectations, right, and personalities, because we're all mates and we all want to do business with mates. But at the same time, the relationship's very important. So for the people listening that want to do something with their mate, what are some things that you would tell them, right, to make sure that you get right up front when you're doing business, not only with your mates, but anybody else that you bring in? And I'm not talking from a finance perspective, just more around kind of personalities, expectations.
Yeah, look, and that's something I'm constantly learning more and more about, trying to align myself with the right type of people. I think where it all starts, and this is where my business partner, Mark, and myself are on the same page, is we've got a similar value set. We didn't sit down at the start and sort of unpack what those values were, but we've known each other for the best part of 25 years. So we sort of understood what we stood for. And when we went into that first property deal, we sort of knew exactly what we wanted to deliver, try it out on a small scale. And if we're able to succeed at that in some form, then we wanted to go and replicate that into bigger deals. So I think that value set is super important, and that's something we've really honed in on this year, is going, what are our core values? What do we stand for as individuals, but also as a company? And then how do we deliver that to the marketplace and communicate that? I think that's important. That's not only in the types of buyers that we're trying to attract, but also in the types of consultants we're wanting to work with, the builders, investors, joint venture partners. And we've learned some pretty tough lessons in the last 2 years in terms of potentially not aligning ourselves with the right people. So that's something that we've really had to step back, go, yes, we've got ambitions to, you know, grow our business and do bigger projects, but first it needs to come back right to a fundamental perspective in terms of who do we align ourselves, who do we want to work with, who are the right types of fit for our business going forward.
Sorry, didn't see you there. While you're here, actually, we've got a new coaching cohort that just opened up for the Unemployable Property Coaching Program that you get taught on how to become a property developer. One-on-one coaching, bi-monthly coaching, and also events where we get a full coach bus with all the students and go to 6-7 different development sites. When I say development sites, from one lot to 10 lots to 50 lots, you get to see exactly why we buy it, how we buy it, how we fund it, and also how you can do it yourself. The next day, we had an amazing event at the QT Hotel here on the Gold Coast, where we had all of our consultants come in and teach everybody on what they're looking for with sites, what are the different trends, and how you can become a property developer yourself. Now you see me on the video, but who you're gonna be getting coached by is Shannon and Carson. Who's Shannon and Carson? 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. Today, they're doing over $100 million worth of land deals. I know you're listening, and I know you want to take action. And if that's you, click on the link below or go to www.unemployableproperty.com.au and register your interest, and one of our team will reach out to you, and we'll see you on the next bus. Now get out of here.
For someone that's looking at doing this with someone, as opposed to just doing it themselves. I guess the thought process is, hey, I'll give away 50% of my profits here, as opposed to, am I actually going to get, you know, am I going to do this more successful with someone in my, you know, in my back corner? I guess I had the same thought process when me and Shannon got together. What's your thoughts around that? And if someone's thinking of partnering with someone as opposed to doing it themselves, what do you think the pros and cons are?
Yeah, to me, I would rather share that experience with someone else. I think it's far more enjoyable, more rewarding when you've got someone there that you can bounce ideas off. You're growing together as a company, and we've grown a hell of a lot in the last sort of 6 years. Not only as people, but as, you know, that partnership as a business. So for me, it's much more rewarding to do things together rather than alone. And I guess it depends. Everyone's different. Some people would prefer to sort of go down that solo path and do things alone. I just think you can achieve far more together if you've got the right partners than you can on your own. That's just my personal take.
Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah, I've seen a lot of them go south. We have some partnerships. And then, you know, I think work ethic's such a huge one as well. Like, I looked at Shannon. I knew he was a goer. And I think the only thing that would frustrate me more than is someone that would, you know, if you're doing 90% of the work and someone's doing 10%,
yeah,
it's going to get frustrated. You're going to get frustrated really quickly. So
yeah,
I think having that upfront and honest conversation with that person, it helps. Obviously, if you've known him for a long time, at the end of the day, you know, you've got to, it's calculated risks is what we're doing. Property development, that's the, you know, and I guess, you know, you can't predict everything, but I think you're right. You can definitely get, you know, a lot of people just look at that and just purely look at the number and go, I'm giving away 50% of the profits. But I know in our instance, we'd be doing probably 25% of what we're doing now if I was trying to do it on my own.
100%. There's a lot of caps you have to wear, right? If you're trying to do it all alone, and you're not going to be good at everything, and Shannon won't be good at everything. It's kind of like trying to divide and conquer and going, you're more suited to this, I'm more suited to this. Let's divide and conquer and then come back together. And I think, to your point, let's just say, you know, 2 years down the track, you know, you realize that maybe that partner, you're going in different directions. You can always hit pause then and go, look, it's, you know, we've got different ambitions with the business. I think it's time we part ways. It's not to say you're wed to that person forever and a day.
I'd love to unpack the journey, because we're starting from the humble beginnings of, we started with one house. Yep. And now off camera, we're talking about the $50 million worth of developments that you're doing at the moment, which are in that, I'd say, mid to high end range, especially in product and quality and location across the Gold Coast. So do you mind us unpacking that first deal?
Yeah.
All right. I love the smile.
What's an all?
Yeah. So, yeah, because, I want to put it into perspective, right, for any viewers that are new in this space. So how did you find the deal? Where did you find the deal? Where did you start? How did it get designed? What did you know, because you didn't have this experience before. So let's unpack that right from the beginning, going, okay, we sat down together and said, we're going to build a house. What then happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably first step we did was we landed on some areas within Brisbane that were within our price range, and we knew we couldn't afford Inner Ring. So we went to that next ring out, and we landed on somewhere around like Cannon Hill, Morningside, Norman Park, sort of just on the outskirts.
Yep.
And we realized pretty fast that was kind of where we're at. We're looking at Camp Hill as well, and that seemed to be just that sort of next level above where we were at the time from a budget perspective. We're very much novices. So all we knew was bank funding. Go to a bank, big bank, ask for a loan, use your borrowing capacity to fund that. That's all we knew. So
basically you're using yours and Mark's serviceability. Okay, you earn X amount.
And the wife's as well.
And the wife's, right? Everyone in there.
Yeah, everyone was in. Yeah.
Show the credit card statement.
That's
right. Pull down the pants. They want to see everything.
Yeah.
And then you got the funding.
Yep.
I'm assuming that you guys were you and the wives all personal guarantees on a loan.
Yep.
Right. And this is the thing, guys, right? It's taking that action. I'm sure that you guys were scared shitless at the beginning going,
all right, we're all in here. We're buying this property. We're signing the personal guarantees, and we're going. Now, how did you work the feasibility on the project? Kind of, was it on the back of a napkin? Did you do a course? How did you learn how to know that I'm going to buy a block of land for X? And I'd love, can we unpack any of the figures on that first project?
Yeah.
Would you be happy with that?
Absolutely. Okay. How we did it, it was a very, like, I'd been following and I've been part of various property groups around Southeast Queensland and national property groups for probably since about 2014.
Yep.
So I'd built a lot of skill sets, but actually hadn't used that. I guess where I was able to extend that feasibility was from the renovation that I personally did, sort of understanding what things typically cost on a micro scale, and then using various feasibility tools. It was a pretty simple feasibility. It was like land purchase,
yep,
and house build. So we're able to package that together pretty easily, and we kept it simple because this was our first deal. How we went through that process was really just, we sourced an agent. We just sort of got friendly with the local agent. He seemed to be, you know, someone that we could trust and easy to deal with. And we just purchased a vacant block of land, kept it nice and simple. Well, what we thought was nice and simple.
How much was that vacant block of land?
450.
So 450,000.
Oh, sorry, it was a little bit more, 480.
480. 480,000. Yep. How much money did you guys have to put down on that property?
Luckily, my business partner, his wife's a doctor, so we got a medical loan, okay. So 10% down.
Wow, so 50 grand.
Yeah.
Call it 50 grand. So you guys are 50 grand in, plus probably some stamp duty,
yep,
and legal costs.
Yep.
What did you do next?
Went and spoke to a number of builders, and we probably spoke to five or six different builders, from custom home builders to spec home builders, just to work out, you know, what the difference was between, and at that stage we're very, very green, so we didn't understand the full difference between a spec home builder and a good spec home builder, mm, versus a custom home builder, mm, and then trying to pinpoint that block of land, did it warrant a spec home? Or could we get away with putting did it warrant a custom home, or could we get away with just putting a spec home on it? And that's kind of where we were sort of questioning. Custom home builder, we're looking at about $600,000 for a house, big sort of a mid tier, not a Metricon or anything like that, but a mid tier spec home builder. You're looking at around sort of 450 all in. So it was kind of like, I think we could get away with a nice spec home here rather than a custom home build. And it ended up being 450 all in, house and pool.
Yeah, so house and pool.
Yeah, so you can see the difference. So that was two story.
How many square meters? How many square meters roughly?
Roughly about 280.
About 200.
Yeah.
That's like on sale kind of prices now, isn't it?
Oh, it was. I think when you do
that for 450 anymore.
When you do the math, I think it's around like 1400, 1500 a square meter. Like it's crazy.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't.
So were you working with an agent at that time just in regards to going, okay, for 480, 450 build, you know, what can we sell this for? And yeah, do you use that same agent to sell the property?
We didn't.
Okay.
We spoke to a number of, because he didn't typically specialize in that area.
Yeah.
He just happened to have this block of land, but his specialist area was another couple of areas. Yep. So we thought, yeah, we'll buy the block, but then we'll contact the best local agents.
Yep.
And try and ballpark. And we did our own research, right? You got to have a look at, okay, we're in this street based on comparable sales.
Yep.
This is where we think it'll end up. So at the time, we sort of thought it'll end up around 1.1 mil, yep, as a resale.
As a resale.
Yeah.
So you're 480 in on the land,
yep,
plus some stamp duties, bits and pieces. Yep. Let's call it 500.
Yep.
You're 450 in for the house and pool.
Yep.
Who managed that? That process.
We did.
You did.
Yeah. 100%.
So subcontracted the builder.
Yep.
Signed a contract. Again, got a bank loan.
Yep.
Right. And I'm assuming it was just progress payments at each stage.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for those of you guys that don't know, when you get a construction loan, the bank will give you a construction loan for $450,000. but they're not giving you $450,000 and putting it in your bank because they know what's going to happen. You're going to take 50 grand of that. You're going to go on a holiday. You're going to take another 50 grand. You're going to put your kids through private school. And then you're going to have the house 75% complete and go, I need more money.
Yeah.
So what they do is they give you progress payments on each, for instance, slab stage, frame stage, you know, roof stage, lockup stage, these types of things.
100%.
And you guys manage that the whole way through.
Absolutely. And we had to manage the builder and the pool builder because the builder didn't want to do the pool contract under theirs.
Yeah.
So we ended up having two separate contracts and that didn't go so well.
Yeah. And that's my next question. What went wrong?
What went wrong from the start?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, council went wrong from the start.
Yeah.
And, we thought we're buying a vacant block of land. What could go wrong with a vacant block of land? It's a registered title, should all be just purchase, contractor builder, and away you go. It had a character overlay, being Brisbane. So because it had a character overlay, you have to submit a development application. And even just for one house build.
What's a character overlay for those of the people that don't know?
Yeah, basically what it means is there's a certain character or style of building within that suburb that the council's trying to preserve.
Yeah.
So when you design your house, it's got to meet certain parameters to fit in with the look and feel of that area.
Yeah.
So it might be things like a little balcony on the front of the house.
So basically you had to come up with a set of plans, put in an application to the Brisbane City Council so they can approve that.
Absolutely.
And that's something that you weren't aware of.
No, we just thought it would be get your house plans and away you go. Get your BA and off you go.
How long did that take to get that approval?
30 days.
30 days.
And then one day for them to take it away.
Oh.
And I'm looking at all your faces and you're like, what the hell?
So they gave it to you and then they took it away.
Yeah. Issued it in writing. And then the next day they issued it another notice saying, you don't have that approval anymore.
What changed?
Nothing. And it's completely illegal or completely against planning law.
So what did you do then?
Well, we just went, what the hell? Asked the town planner, like, can I actually do this legally? And he's like, no, they can't. So he's challenged them and we were expecting them to sort of go, okay, yep, you got us. Here's your approval again. And they didn't. They just dug their heels in more and said, no, too bad, you don't have it. Basically asked my whole network, asked people that have been in the game for years and years and years, like, is this actually a thing? Can they actually do this? Everyone's like, I've never heard of this ever happening. I can't give you any advice because we've never dealt with it, never heard of it. So we're pulling our hair out going, this should have been a very simple in and out. And now we're faced with a complete unknown situation. So we consulted a legal firm, local legal firm in Brisbane, and said, look, is this lawful? And they basically said, no, they've completely acted outside their power. They can't do this. But the only way that we can kind of get them to move is to issue a almost like a show cause type notice with an intent to go to court. So planning and environment court, which obviously just to get there's like $20,000. This being our first development, we're already delayed 8 weeks, just trying to figure out what we're going to do. And then we're sort of faced with the threat of having to start the process of $20,000 just to go to court. And then all of the legal fees that go behind that.
There would be some hard conversations around the dinner table with your wife when she's like, I thought you said you knew what you were doing.
It's so simple. This is my dream.
Right? I personally guaranteed on this loan and you're telling me we can't build anything on it?
Yeah.
So where did it go?
So that was a tough thing, right? It's like, because then Mark, my business partner, is like, oh, let's sell the block. I'm like, but then that person can't build on it. No one's going to want to buy this thing. Who's going to want something they can't buy? Build on.
Did they give any justification or any reasoning behind the retraction?
Yeah, so the history of the block was someone did it had two lots. So someone picked the house up on the original lot, moved it to one side and left the vacant block there. And then the house itself had like a very small section of the roof line that overhung our block. So about a meter by about 4 meters, so call it 4 square meters. very common throughout Brisbane. Like there's hundreds of cases of the exact same thing. So he did that, registered the two new titles with an easement over where the roof line was.
Yeah.
So then when councils declined the application a day after approving it, their justification was because that roof line overhangs our block, technically that constitutes a dual occupancy. So you need to apply for a dual oc.
Oh.
And we're like, you've got to be kidding me. Like there's an easement that says that's in favor of the neighboring block, not us.
Wow.
So that was their justification. And we're just like, that's completely flawed. I think there was something behind the scenes that we're unaware of that was kind of driving that.
Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening?
Yeah. So we engaged the lawyer and basically we pretty well wrote the letter, did the research, had 100 pages of other examples within Brisbane of this exact same scenario, basically laid it on a platter for the lawyer to put in a 2 or 3 page letter, basically threatening to go to court, called the mayor, called every councillor that had anything to do with planning and that local area, and basically just threw out basically just threw the kitchen sink at this thing. And the legal letter managed to do the job. 2 weeks later, we got a response saying, oh, yep, you can have your approval back now.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, and this is the thing, right? Like, you have to push, right? The easy thing to do is just sell the block, lose a little bit of money and go, I'm not doing developing ever again in my life. And you'll probably be in that same job or in a job again, right? And this is the thing with councils, right? Is sometimes they get it wrong. But what would you have done now that you know that? What would you do again prior to actually buying that block of land to actually find these things out? Because a lot of people will look at a block of land and go, okay, yeah, this looks good, I'll buy it. And then all of a sudden go, oh man, I can't do this and I can't do that. So would you have, knowing what you do now, would you maybe put like a condition on a contract and maybe a little bit of due diligence as an example so that you can actually go and contact council and see if they'll give you an approval or not based on that?
Sometimes contacting council too early is a double-edged sword.
Yep.
So you got to be very careful around when and when you don't contact council. I would have definitely spoke to the town planner.
Yep.
But I don't think the town planner would have given us any different advice because he was always of the mindset that this is completely legitimate.
Yep.
Development.
Yep.
And when council actually declined the application, it literally caught everyone by surprise.
That's everyone's nightmare, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're building one house or whether you're doing like what Shannon and Carson are doing, and you know, developing multiple blocks of land, the last thing you want to do is buy something that you're stuck with.
Yeah.
That you're not going to be able to sell because, well, there's two things. One is morally, you know, that you're selling something to someone else that they can't do anything with either. So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place if you actually care.
Yeah.
Right. So you got the approval.
Yep.
What else went wrong?
COVID. So we bought in 2019 because of the council delays. That obviously delayed the builder starting. So they didn't actually start until the beginning of 2020. So they were about 3 months in and then COVID hit. And obviously the market went sideways and we finished right in that sort of really fearful, unknown period around sort of middle of 2020. Before the market really took off at the back end of 2020. So we were selling probably in, if not the most difficult, one of the most difficult times within COVID, just before that boom. So it sat on the market for 12 to 16 weeks.
The finished product.
Yeah. So
when everyone hit pause.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everyone was really edgy. You could kind of see there was some activity coming back into the market, but everyone was super cautious. We had a contract after the first open home and literally they crashed it 3 days later. And then we had zero action for 12 weeks. We had to change agents, get a new agent on it. And she managed to sell it, but we had to lower the price expectations. So we were sort of hoping for about a $1.1 million sale, and we ended up with $1,050,000.
$1,050,000.
Yeah.
So throughout this entire process, the amount of time, effort, and everything, it wasn't a great project from a profitability.
I think we walked away with $20,000.
$20,000.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't do it again.
Depends how you.
Yeah.
There's learnings. Yes.
The learning
money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely not.
So you finish this project. You have a few battle scars. How do you? I just want to piece the puzzle together for people going, how do you go from, you know, investing, say, $50,000 into a deal between four people, right? Husband and wife partners, to then, you know, X amount of years later, 6 years later, now doing over $50 million worth of development. So I just want to unpack that journey. So you guys are cashed out, $20,000. Right, you're probably
loaded,
right? You're cheering, you're having a glass of wine, not the best wine because you can't afford it.
No.
Smooth gifts.
I'm
there.
You're back to the drawing board. What was next?
Next was we looked for another house, but we looked in the next suburb up. So we looked for something a little bit more higher end, and we ended up with Balmoral.
Did you look for any overhanging roofs onto your property?
100%. Yeah, we learned that lesson. And we just wanted something clean, clear.
Yeah.
No issues at all.
So when you're looking and you bought in Balmoral.
Yep.
So where are you looking? Are you on realestate.com? Are you like, why Balmoral? How did you find it? Because this is probably one of the biggest questions people ask me, and I know that people ask Shannon and Carson, is how do you find it? Yeah. How do you know that's the one to buy?
Just before you go there, though, when you finished that first deal, was there any of those tough conversations with the missus saying, I don't think this, we should keep doing this? Because after all of that, a lot of people do tap out at that point.
Yeah.
So were you just like, nah, I'm taking the learnings, this is what I want to do? Or were you still trying to work out in your own mind if this is just a little side gig, or where was your head at after that first project?
It was a bit of a kick in the guts to put all that time and effort into something and just walk away with $20,000 between us. Like,
yeah,
it's pretty deflating.
And you're working full time.
Absolutely.
Like on top of it all.
Yeah. And COVID, right? With all the added stress and, you know, everyone was there. So we all sort of felt the pressure that sort of brought. A lot of unknown. I'd say probably not for a second did I ever think this was it. I was just like, look, we learn a lot. We've come away with a tiny little bit of money, but I love property and I think there's a bright future for the property market overall. Yeah. And I just couldn't see myself doing anything else. To be completely honest, I was just like, yeah, that was a really tough start, but this is what I want to do long term, and I just can't picture myself doing anything else.
They're awesome.
So yeah, it was, yep, take the lesson, let's apply it to the next one, and let's make sure that one is a much bigger success.
Yep. So how did you find that deal, and why Balmoral?
So same agent.
Yep.
That we bought that other block of land off in Cannon Hill.
Yep.
That was more of his area. We were, like you said, we were on everything. So we were contacting agents. We were on realestate.com. We found sites in all different ways. A lot of them have come through agents, but then others we've just found online when any person could have had a fair crack at it. This one had just come online literally within a day, and I think he called us maybe a day before it came online.
Yeah.
And was like, they're going to take this to auction. It was early 21 and the market was firing, so there was no room for negotiation. There was no room for, you know, delayed settlements or even due diligence terms. They were not being accepted. So I think we managed to negotiate. We just said, look, we'll come and see it tomorrow. We saw it and we're like, yep, we think that's the one for us. We were able to run some numbers very, very quickly. Just based on our recent experience at Cannon Hill, we sort of knew what we'd be up for. We also made some contacts with some custom home builders as well.
Okay.
So they were able to provide us a little bit of intel in terms of build costs. Mm. So that really helped, because it was a sloping block, not like a nice, flat, easy to build on block, but we're able to get some numbers off them and then punch that into a FISO. So we did that really quickly. Like I'm talking within 24 hours and we had to make a decision, yay or nay. And we just basically said, if you give us 60 days, we'll take it. And this is the price, don't take it to auction. And we managed to secure it like that.
So out of that first property, you made 20 grand profit.
Yep.
You had 50 or so grand in it already.
Yep.
So you come up with 70 odd grand.
Yep.
Using some round numbers.
Yep.
You then buy this new block of land. How much was that block?
550.
So 550.
Yeah.
So same type of thing. Did you use the medical 10%?
Same thing. Yeah.
So exactly.
Rinse and repeat. Yeah.
Rinse and repeat. So 10%, $55,000 down plus a bit of stamps.
Yep.
Same type of process.
Yeah. So that. Probably the difference on that one was we, the contracted name was our business name at the time. So we had a long-term vision around getting the structure set so that we could buy in the entity, start to demonstrate to the bank the borrowing capacity as income started to be generated, because that takes time, right? You've got to be thinking, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ahead, getting your structure right from the start. So we thought, yep, we'll buy in the entity, not personal names.
Yep.
And we're all guarantors. Yep. So my business partner and myself and our wives.
Yeah. And still traditional bank finance at this stage.
Yeah. Yep. So that was through ANZ at the time.
Through ANZ.
Yep.
So bought the block of land, 550.
Yep.
This one wasn't a spec home. This was a custom build.
This is custom.
Yep. Yeah. And how much did that custom build?
We signed a contract for just over 800. I think it ended up being around 880. But obviously with
COVID,
you know, we all saw what happened with build prices in that. Yep. In that year, it pretty well went up 25-30%.
Yep.
How do you navigate that when they're coming back to you saying, I'm going to lose money on this? I spoke to some other developers who are just like, stuff you.
Yep.
You know, I'm not giving you anything extra. And then the builder either drags its feet, walks away to another job, or that is willing to pay extra, because how did you navigate that period when?
Yeah, they never directly came to us and were sort of like, oh, can you guys tip in some more money? There were some variations, and I mean, I think they probably added like a decent sort of margin on there. So, you know, our contract started 800, ended up at around 880. I don't think they lost money. I just don't think they made money. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just, given we were doing another project at the same time, we sort of took on another project shortly after securing this one. Mm-hmm. And we weren't flush with cash either. We kind of just went, look, it is what it is. We're copping it pretty well on all ends at the moment. This is about as good as we can do.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the prices were going up just as quickly. So the people that had to pay that little bit extra,
yeah,
the prices were going through the roof, because it's good that you jumped in then, because I had a bit of a block in my head where I was like, I'm a hard negotiator, and I got left behind.
Yeah.
Market 2021.
Yeah.
I was trying to negotiate hard.
Yeah.
I'm not paying asking price. I always pay asking under asking price.
Yeah.
And I should have been paying overs just because I didn't read the market.
Yeah.
And it was just
the ego gets in the way sometimes. Huh?
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just add, you touched on a good point before with your offer. So it was going to auction, but you put an offer in prior to the auction.
Hmm.
Do you go to auctions and buy typically, or you always make that early?
Just trying to think if we bought at auction once.
Yeah.
Yep. So typically we'll try and avoid it. And if we are going to go to auction, probably a good tip is to, this can work one of two ways. You might show your cards too early in terms of what you're willing to pay. And then they may say, no, thanks for your offer, come to auction. And they kind of know what you're willing to pay. So that can work against you. So you got to be careful. But if it succeeds, if you're like, here's a strong offer, because you're not going to be able to, you know, get it under market value, because why would you? Yeah. Especially if it's a hot market, right? Like, why would you take it early and a lower offer if you could actually milk the full process? So go in hard. You're probably going to have to, you know, give them a price that's attractive for them to say yes to due diligence clause, because you usually want a due diligence clause. You may want a delayed settlement, like, you know, 90 days, 120 days. And we've been able to negotiate that even under auction conditions. Mm-hmm. So
look,
the one auction we did and we were successful at, we did pre-offer. And luckily the agent bought us the site prior to it even being advertised. And we did our absolute best to get it. They just said, look, thanks for your offer. We're going to take it and run the auction campaign. And then we showed up on auction day and we managed to pick it up about $100,000 less than what we'd offered pre-auction. So,
That always a nice little bonus.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So bringing us back to that deal. So you're in at about $1.43 million. Any warts on that one, or was it pretty smooth?
To be honest, aside from obviously the COVID, so obviously there were delays in build time.
Yep.
Costs went up slightly.
Yep.
It was a sloping block. So probably the hardest thing was just deciding on how we were going to finish off the backyard. Because it was quite sloped, it's like you're trying to give buyers to maximize your end price as flat a backyard as possible, which is a challenge. So there's quite a bit of retaining and so forth that was needed to try and maximize that. So aside from really those aspects, the main one was, and this is what we've learned, so this is a pretty good tip for those out there, is if you're running two projects or multiple projects at the same time, make sure that they're structured under different entities. Being novices, we signed a contract for this house under our company name, and then we purchased a second, like a townhouse, slightly bigger project under the same entity. And we've learned the hard way when we were going for loans that our lending on one of them affected the lending on the other. Basically, the bank picked up that we had a loan. And because it was through private lending, that actually put a security over our company.
Yeah.
And then ANZ picked that up and said, what's this security that's been lodged against your company?
I want to unpack that a little bit, because obviously you went from traditional finance to the third one.
Yeah.
Was private finance. And I want to know, I want to get into the story of how you found out about private finance and what that deal looked like.
Yeah.
So I don't know, what, $1.43 million plus a bit of extra costs of landscaping in the backyard and whatnot.
Yeah.
What did you actually end up selling it for?
So I think all in, it ended up being around, when we're all said and done, 1819, and we sold it for 2.35.
Yeah. So about
It was probably about 400. Yeah. I think once agents were paid out, all GST, because you have to pay GST, obviously.
Yeah. So the wives were talking to you again at that point.
Exactly. We're all good then.
Easier conversations to be had.
Had a better wine that time.
Yeah, better wine. Yeah, we had enough for dinner.
Yeah.
It's amazing, you know, like the reason why I like to unpack these deals, you know, rather than going, hey, what would you do in this scenario? It's real, it's raw. Like you can't write a book about this type of thing, you know, like you're literally feeling like you've been scanned by counsel to, you know, making $20,000 on your first project. Most people would just be like, this is just too hard. You know, most wives would just be like, are you crazy? You want to do this again? You're risking ourselves personally and family and time and effort. And then you guys go again and you know, make $450,000 or so on that next one. And a lot of people sit there and go, easy for you to say, because, you know, you got that COVID uplift. And at the end of the day, it still took time. It still took effort. You still had to take action. A lot of people at that point in time were scared shitless, right? Like me being in the property game, being in the development game, you know, I sold some properties at that time, which I still to today regret. And that's why I'm in such a big build and keep phase at the moment, because I feel like I got PTSD and I'm going to be looking 5 years from now going, why did I sell that thing? I did it before and I'm going to do it again. What the heck? But again, we don't have a crystal ball to see what's happening in the market, because when you're in the market, you're in the market. Like, you know, things are moving, but then you always have the person on your shoulder going, yeah, but it's moving too fast. The market's going to crash, you know, like you just don't know what's going to happen at that point in time. So what made you, and what you were saying before, I just want to go back quickly when you mentioned about the second townhouse site. So make sure, guys, when you guys are looking at doing these types of developments, right, sit down with an accountant, sit down with your lawyer, tell them what you're doing and have a plan to make sure structures, like I'm massive on that, crossing T's and dotting I's when it comes to structure. I've got that many entities and that many trusts that are related for that exact same reason. And it not only is it great for lending, but it's also great for asset protection. So make sure that you get legal advice on this, sit down with a good accountant and unpack what you're trying to do, right? Because very, very important, you can't go back. Like you could have screwed yourself there massively, right?
Absolutely.
So you've got that one done, but in the meantime that you were selling this one that you made the 450, you've bought another site and you mentioned that you used private lending. What's the difference between private lending and obviously standard residential lending for a developer like yourself? And how did you even find out about it?
Yeah, good question. So private lending is, you've got your, I guess, your big four banks. So everyone knows about them. And that's all we knew of about, you know, at the time. If you want money, you go to an ANZ or an NAB, Westpac, and you ask cap in hand for some money. Just being more and more exposed to different people in the industry, seeing how they're doing different deals, especially bigger deals, right? As soon as you go from doing your ones and twos, I think the number is, the critical number is three in big bank land. Once you're doing more than three, I think it becomes commercial, lending. So then that obviously takes you into a whole different sphere where you're looking at things like lower LVRs, potentially pre-sales, and higher fees and so forth. So it becomes a lot more rigid and a lot harder to get lending through your big banks. Plus they want to see that you've got history of delivering projects. We knew at the time that, and the project that we're looking at was five townhouses. We didn't have the runs on the board to go to a big bank and say, we want to do five townhouses. Oh, and by the way, we're doing a single house build in Balmoral. At the same time, we've maxed out our borrowing capacity on that. So we're completely tapped out. But this project is a great project. There's about $1 million profit in it. But we can't service the loan. So just through our networks that we'd been exposed to in the last sort of 2 to 3 years of being in the space, and obviously prior to that, you know, I've built the network up over about 10 years, this whole private lending came up. And basically what that is, it's a couple of tiers down beneath your big banks. So your big banks, and then under that, you've got the likes of like a Macquarie and Bendigo Bank and banks like that. Then under that,
Bank,
La Trobe Lending. And then you go down to these, what they call private funders. And essentially they could be family office money. They could be funds. They're different types of structures under the traditional bank lenders out there.
Yep. And the big difference with these lenders is they look at it from a project specific.
Yep.
So they're not sitting there going, okay, show me your BAS statements, show me your income taxes, I want to see your credit card statements and how much money you're spending on Uber Eats and all this type of thing.
Yeah.
They look at it as a project to project basis. The big difference with this type of lending, I've learned a lot about this type of lending in a very short period of time because I was always doing traditional bank finance as well. And then I always heard about this type of finance through, you know, mentors of mine in the development space. And it just seemed a little bit scary, right? Like, it's kind of like, ooh, yeah, but you always hear the ones that, you know, screw you over and, you know, take you to the cleaners and all this type of thing. And you got to manage that risk, right? But I always thought to myself, I'm like, I know other people doing projects. And I'm like, how the hell are these guys doing, you know, 15 units and 20 units and 30 units and, you know, 50 townhouses. And I kind of know who they are. I know what they do. I've got businesses, I've got income coming in, and these guys are just doing this full time. I'm like, where are they getting this money from?
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
That's like really opened my eyes up to that whole side of private lending. And Shannon and Carson, that they've been unpacking their story over the last few months, was the same thing, right? Because they were just always using joint venture partners, which you're giving away a lot of equity for obviously them financing the deal.
Yeah.
And with these private lenders, it's basically like having a JV partner, but just not as expensive, I guess. And the beauty with private lending is they're not going to lend it to you if they don't like the project anyways. So they're almost like a gatekeeper for you.
Absolutely.
At the same time, if you're using the right ones, I mean, from the experience that I've been having lately. So unpack this five townhouse story.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we were introduced to the lender we ended up using in the end for this project was through a mortgage broker who was starting to branch out more into offering different types of lending for developers and people that couldn't get through your traditional means.
Yeah.
So that's how the introduction came on this specific project. Obviously, once we found the site, it was around the same time that we purchased the Balmoral. I think it was about a month or two later. So same sort of scenario in terms of there wasn't much negotiating power there at all on really anything, price or terms. So we managed to get, I think it was a 60-day settlement.
Yep.
But we pretty well had to pay the price he wanted.
This is on the townhouse site, right?
This is on the townhouse site.
And where was this?
Palm Beach.
Palm Beach.
Yeah, here.
Is that the one that we were talking off camera about?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I know the site.
That's the one. So, yeah, basically we managed to get a 60-day settlement. Look, I would definitely not recommend this to anyone. We got a 30-day window where we could do some due diligence around the numbers. So obviously we'd never been through this on a townhouse site before. So we literally just called everyone we knew in terms of town planners, agents, consultants, and it was DA approved. So that gave us a level of comfort that that part of it was taken care of. It was more trying to, I guess, work out what the build costs were going to be, what the end sales were going to be, how much, you know, extra cost there was going to be to get it from DA to a building approved development.
With the costs, I think that's where a lot of people get stuck. Trying to branch out from, you know, a cookie cutter builder to then jumping into a townhouse build. Yep. Are you at that point to verify those costs? Are you just going out to multiple builders and asking them for quotes? Because I'm assuming the detailed design. Well, if it's just DA approved,
it was just DA approved.
So you still got to go through the next level of approval. Are you just getting some estimates, or are you getting a quantity surveyor to go for it? What level of detail are you going to get some comfort where you can just go
in 30 days?
Yeah,
in 30 days.
30 days. So
yeah, luckily we were introduced to the site by a builder contact of mine. So one of his best friends was the agent, listing agent. And so he is a builder, and he basically, the way we structured it was like, he introduced us to the site, as in the builder introduced us to the site. He said, look, if we can put it all together, and this was in agreement with the real estate agent, it was like, if we can get it all together, you'll build it, you'll sell it. And we managed to sort of work out a bit of a way forward. So he agreed to price it up for us. But then we also went to another builder that had done one literally a street away. Exact same thing, five townhouses, just finished. And we said, look, would you guys be interested in building this? Because we wanted to make sure we had options. If it didn't work out with this builder that we were preferring, we had a really solid backup to go to.
Yeah.
So they were good enough to sort of give us a figure on what they built theirs for. They didn't do detailed analysis and sort of break down based on our plans.
Yeah.
But we sort of knew within a level of confidence based on the two numbers that we had that this was the build cost and sales price. That's where it was at that point in time, and there was enough in it.
Okay. And looking at your journey,
yeah,
when you bought that, I think you said you hadn't sold the other house at that point.
So no, it was literally, we purchased them like within 2 months of each other.
So I'm assuming based on your previous project, you probably didn't have all the cash. Did you bring in some investors at that point for that project? And if so, how do you structure that? Are you giving up equity, or are you giving them a return on their money? And for the person coming in, if someone's listening to this and they're looking to just invest in someone's project,
yep,
what advice do you have to them for security? Because I've seen so many people get completely destroyed because they haven't got any kind of security over what's going on, and they haven't done the proper due diligence because they've just trusted the developer's numbers. So if you can give us an answer kind of both ways, how you structured that deal and what the investors got.
Absolutely. So luckily with the Balmoral property, back to that, because of the increase in the property, like within the time that we signed the contract to when we actually settled and then got it revalued, it had gone up about 10%.
Nice.
So we didn't actually have to tip in any more money for construction.
Yeah.
That allowed us to grab whatever funds we had saved up. And this was like, I'm talking personal funds here. So not the funds from Cannon Hill.
Yeah.
We'd already exhausted those funds. It was more personal funds that we then tipped into Palm Beach just to secure the site and get it to a point where we could actually start the design process and actually settle it. We managed to get a 90-day settlement on that. And at the 30-day window when we'd satisfied our DD, basically, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, and I don't recommend anyone do this, we actually went unconditional, not knowing where we were going to get the funds to actually settle the site.
Is so, fixed in 90 days or 60 days?
In a further 60 days. So we needed 750 grand. We had about 100 of that.
Yeah.
So we need another 650. We didn't know where that was going to come from, and we needed 60 days to raise that. So
that was the balance that you needed, plus whatever bank private lending that you're getting. So the 650 was your developer tipping amount.
Exactly. Just
the private lender to say, okay, I'm going to give you, you know, what LVR was on? Was that the 65, 70% LVR?
Yeah, it was pretty low to actually settle. Yes. Construction was better, but to actually, obviously the way that they structure their security, they'll give you less on the land component. Yeah. They'll usually give you more on the build.
Correct.
Yeah. It was about, we purchased for around 2 mil and we had to tip in around 750.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have...
Don't recommend it. It was very, very stressful.
I bet. That's a pretty ballsy move, but
or stupid.
Yeah, one up, one down. Hindsight, let's go with ballsy. But let's unpack that quickly. Was it just because of the network that you've been around, you had enough confidence in conversations of people that are saying, hey, I'm keen to get involved with projects to make that bold move of saying, okay, I'm confident that we can raise that money in the next 60 days? Like, were you having those conversations in the background, but... Obviously, you haven't got any of that money over the line yet. What gave you the confidence to do that?
Yeah, we were 100% right. We were having those conversations in the background. There was indications that the money would come in, but there was nothing in writing saying, yes, we're going to commit X amount of dollars into it. And something that probably tipped me over the line was a mentor of mine, basically. He's got this saying where if the deal's good enough or it stacks, the money will come. And I just had that in the back of my mind. And I'm like, look, we want this. If we want it bad enough, we will do whatever's required to get the money in. And we literally spent that next 60 days blasting the network, just
hustling.
Yeah.
Anyone and everyone that would listen to us, look, if you want in, this is what we're paying. And we're paying 20% per annum. So we're paying a good return.
Yep.
And that was quite attractive. Obviously, and then we managed to secure an investor for pretty well most of the money. He said, I'll give you 500 to settle and then another 350 towards construction.
Mm, nice.
And 9 days from settlement, he pulled out, didn't he?
Oh,
come on.
Yeah.
Brutal.
So what'd you do?
We had a meltdown, and then literally within the hour, just on the phones again, just... ringing everyone we knew. Is like, look, we've just had an investor. We had 500 grand we thought we had coming in. We've got to settle in 9 days.
It's now 30% per annum.
Yeah. Luckily, the broker we'd been working with, he had seen the deal. He liked the numbers. He liked the project. And he's like, look, leave it with me. I think I can pull some together. So he basically put some of his own money in and some people in his network. So it's those relationships. You've really got to build those relationships because they're absolutely key, because when you're in the shit, this is where they can come in handy. So that's what saved us.
That's awesome.
It's definitely not recommended, though.
No.
That's not financial advice.
Definitely some strong moves there between ballsy and stupid, like you said. So, all in all, you put 100 in yourself. You went back to the broker and you got some mezzanine money to settle it and get the loan through.
Yep.
What were the terms on the loan? That was a private funder?
The mez or the prop?
The private, if you can unpack that. What was like the total LVR? What was the term?
Yeah. So basically it was an agreed settlement just for the land, but the goal was then to tip into construction as soon as we had all the documentation ready to go and a builder appointed. So I think initially we had a 4-month term, bit ambitious.
That's short.
But we thought at the time, oh, we've got a DA set of plans here where, you know, it should be just a few months and we should be able to roll in to construction. We've got the builder there ready to go. We've got the sales agent there ready to go. So we had a lot of things there ready to go. Unfortunately, because the consultants were so busy, it took us about 6 months to actually get from DA to starting the build. We had to extend that facility by a couple of months. And
were they pretty friendly with that process with extending or?
Yes, they were, but they charged us for the privilege.
And this is the thing with private lending, guys. It's not like traditional home loans where you have, you know, amortized over 25 years or over 30 years. When they're offering you, you know, the $1.3 million or $1.4 million, just using quick numbers, they gave Chris a 6-month term. So your 25-year term is not 25 years, it's 6 months. And what happens is if you go over the 6 months, there's then penalty interest rates.
Default interest.
Yep. And, you know, different types of fees that come into play. So one thing I would highly, highly recommend, and we're going through this right now on a project, is working with a friendly private lender that is a bit more flexible on terms, because all these fees, right, that you don't have in your as a line item, because you're going, oh, 6 months is plenty of time, eats away at your profit. Every line item that you're adding on there is just adding it on, you know, taking away from the profit. So I highly recommend just making sure that there's a lot of lenders out there that will give you 9 months as an example. And if you do it in 6 months, they don't charge you for those extra 3 months. They'll just say, oh, okay, well done. Now let's roll into construction. Mm-hmm. Some of them, they will charge you a fee as well. So make sure you're asking the right questions. My big advice to anyone listening right now that has no idea about private lending, right, is get referred to a private lender and pay for their time. Just sit down with them after, you know, you're listening to these podcasts, and we're trying to dig as deep as possible, obviously, but we're not going to cover everything in an hour to hour and a half podcast. Pay for their time, just like a town planner, pay for their time, sit down, use ChatGPT, use the questions that we're asking, pay for their time, ask the questions so you can get a good understanding. So when you're starting to look for property and you're doing feasibilities, you can have that in there, right? Because it's very, very important. You want to go in with your eyes open. The last thing you want to do is get slogged with this fee and that fee. And that's how a lot of these private lenders make their money, right? Like, they're not the banks, they're private funders. Think about yourself. If you have millions and millions of dollars sitting in your bank account that you're lending, you want to make sure that you're going to get as much snippets along the way as possible.
And that it's secure.
Correct.
You want to make sure it's in a safe place and it's on a good project and with a good team.
Yeah. And on that, if you're getting that 6-month or 12-month initial loan, a lot of the time they're happy with just a 3-month minimum earn. So you might have 12 months, and like Eric said, if you pay it back earlier, they're, as long as they get at least 3 months and you're paying a premium for it, we've got, Shannon and I got one at the moment, they're happy to do that deal. So they're getting a great rates, you know, they're getting next to nothing sitting in the bank. Yeah. And have it out the door, even for a short period, they're happy. So,
and the value of, and I guess what gave us a level of comfort, because this was our very first exposure to private lending. And like my business partner, he's basically like, oh, similar to you, Eric, he was like, it sounds all a little bit of sharky and I don't like it, like very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The thing that gave us the comfort was we had a
a good broker that we trusted who was kind of in the background breaking the terms around it. And even to this day, we're on both of our deals in action at the moment. We've used a good trusted broker that's actually brokered that term, probably far better than we could have. And we've been able to find and secure private lenders that are like really above board, very trusted in the industry, and not those ones that may have existed, you know, 10 or 15 years ago that would literally, you know, take the shirt off your back sort of thing.
It's so funny because this private lending sector is growing at such a fast rate.
Yeah.
A lot of the big banks typically aren't even interested in this type of thing anymore. You know, they're rather the 25, 30 year mom-pa home loans, unless, you know, you're like the amount of money you need to be earning to be servicing these types of builds is just out of reach for most people. And I was talking to a valuer and I said, so tell me, these smaller scale projects, right, up to say 20, what's the ratio of traditional versus private lending? He goes, 70% of my deals that I'm looking at right now are all through private lenders. And the other thing is it's quick.
Yep.
Right? Like you can access the money very, very quickly. Like the money is literally sitting there.
Yep.
Whereas with the banks, there's so many more hoops that you got to go through, right? And you're just waiting in that lineup. Yep. So right now as an example, and it changes.
Yeah.
So right now we're talking to a broker about a potential deal, and he's like, there's actually a lot more money in the system right now that needs to be placed than actually projects to be placed, right? Which is putting pressure, and there's some half decent deals out there.
Yep.
That can change in 3 months or 6 months. All that money can be placed, and all of a sudden the money's dried up and it's a lot harder. And then when you go and do your next private lend in 3 months' time, Chris, as an example, and you're going, and I'm like, I'm telling you what I got 3 months ago, and all of a sudden you're going, hold on, I'm paying 2% more than that. It's because there's not as much money in the system. Whereas in a big bank, like if you're going to ANZ and going, I'm getting a 30-year, you know, loan for 6.35, and you've got an, you know, AAA rating, I might go and get one for 6.65 as an example. There's not going to be that huge disparity, which in the private lending space, there definitely can be.
Absolutely.
So go ahead.
No, I'll just jump back into the deal. So the townhouses, you've got your builder. Did you end up going with the initial builder? And then what happened from there?
Yeah, so went with the initial builder, and obviously it was getting towards the back end of 21, so obviously sales were going very, very well. So our FISO was literally week to week, it was moving. So that was both build costs plus sale costs. So it was a nightmare. I think we did that FISO like every week. You're redoing it. Like it was just really hard to keep up. And we ended up, initially, I think we projected around about a $2.4 million build. We end up signing a contract for around $2.7
million.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But then the sales were sort of projecting, I think it was circa, say, $6.5 million. We ended up selling the whole lot for about $7 million, or just over $7 million. So, yeah, it was kind of all just this moving beast, and very, very hard to keep up. And then even when we were building, you know, the cost kept going. It wasn't just that 2021, it was 22. And I mean, they've kept going since then, not at the same speed, but they're definitely not coming back.
I've bought a site in Palm Beach.
Yep.
Probably, what was yours, about 800, 850?
No.
Square meters? No.
Oh, all right. Six.
Oh, yours was a bit smaller, yeah.
30?
Ours is a bit bigger. Ours is closer to 900.
Yep.
But we've paid double what you paid, and not too long ago, and this is the thing, like that whole corridor, the pricing is just increasing,
you know,
because they're not building more land in these spots. And I know the exact site, right? You are literally 2 to 250 meters away from the beach, on the western side of the highway there. So these sites in these prime locations are getting hard, and it was a corner site at the same time, so they're getting harder and harder to come by. So how much profit did you actually come out of that with?
We projected $1 million, and we came back with about $7 to $7.50.
Yeah. After you
that was project profit.
Correct.
The project took at least probably 3 months longer, just the build time blew out. And so, yeah, project proper was about 750.
Yeah.
Our investors ended up making more money than we did on it. So we split that with the investors.
Yeah.
I think in the end, we walked around with about 300.
Yeah.
And they walked with 450.
What's a good deal in your eyes? Like, what's the magic? Is it a profit on cost number that you're looking for? Like, what, when your feasibility, you know, says this number, what is that in your eyes?
Probably two or three key numbers. I'll look at the profit on overall cost, and I want to get that. And I was talking to someone the other day, actually. They're seeing, and this is a broker we're seeing here, and he sees all deals, like lots of deals all day, every day. Yep. And he's saying good margin at the moment is 15% profit on cost. If you can get it to that, you're doing pretty well. Just shows, don't know about in the land subspace, but in built form.
Now, when you say profit on cost, for those that don't know, what does that cost entail? So are we talking land, build, sales, interest? Are we talking everything?
Yeah. I like to look at the GST, agent, everything. So you look at the total dollars that's needed to finish that project and then what's left over. And then you look at the percentage of what's left over versus what the whole project's cost.
Yep.
So yeah, probably 15%. And then the other one would be cash on cash return.
Yeah.
So if you can, okay, your profit on cost is 15%. Okay, that's the bar. But how much cash do I actually need to tip in of my own money and then investor money? And what's the return on that cash that you've got to tip in?
Yeah.
And the higher that number, I don't have a minimum number, but I'd want to see above 50% because you can average that out. You can go, okay, if I've got cash in the deal for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years,
yeah,
what's that average over the length of time that my cash is actually in the deal? And you can work out an annual return that cash.
On the 300 that you guys made,
how
long did that take from start to finish? You tipping in the initial 100, you said, to you actually getting the 300 into the bank account?
Just over 2 years.
2 years. So you look at that. That's a 300% return, as an example, on your money over 2 years.
Yep.
150% a year, right? When you divide it by two. And this is the thing. A lot of people would be like, well, all that money and you only made 300.
Yep.
Right? Yes, you spent a bit of time. There's a bit of stress. There's personal guarantees in place and stuff like that. And you're learning as you go. Like, I honestly take my hat off to you. Because you went from like 0 to 100 really quick.
Yeah.
Right. Most people would not go along this journey. But at the same time, when I look at some of these projects, right, the first one you make, you know, 20 grand and you learn, the second one you make 450 to 500 on one house, you've done five townhouses here and you've made 300. So sometimes it's not all about the size of the project, right? Sometimes these smaller projects, like I know that Shannon and Carson are doing, are juicier sometimes than these bigger projects, right? Because a lot of us love to use vanity metrics, right, at the same time and go, oh yeah, I've done an $8 million project. But most people are going to be like, well, this guy's making millions of dollars, right? But what I like about what you're doing is you're just having a go and just overcoming the fear of personal guarantees and traditional, you know, private lending and this type of thing. So where did you, like, are you going to stick to this area of kind of medium density development? Because I know these next projects that we'll talk about, you're actually upping the game again, right? So why are you kind of staying in that? Why aren't you using going back to the small one houses and making these 500s? And why aren't you kind of going a little bit bigger?
Yeah, we just found that doing the ones and twos, which we've done, there's a lot of competition. So it makes it really hard to actually acquire sites. Plus we're finding that the margins in those for the effort and time and the risk, actually, there can be quite a lot of risk even in the small ones, which we've also found out. A little bit of extra effort to step up into that next bracket of medium density where we're finding is paying much better dividends. And we found the competition lessens as you go to that next level. What we're finding is you don't have your mum and dad developers sort of competing for that type of stock. And you also don't have your big developers that are looking at it because it's just not worth their their time. So we've found our sweet spot in that medium density sort of area, anywhere from sort of 4 units and up is kind of where we're intending on staying. And that way it's sort of more manageable. You can get in and out of a project within usually about 2 to 2.5 years. As soon as you start going bigger than that, you know, you're looking at like 3, 4, 5 years potentially. And then, and for us, the market can change a hell of a lot in that time. So it can really, I guess, leave you out of pocket if you're in a project for that long. So the risk there for us just doesn't make sense.
So I know from here you moved into your into some duplexes and bits and pieces. Just before we go there, with the sales side of things, were you selling stuff off the plan or were you waiting to the finished product? What's your strategy then and what do you like to do now?
Look, because that was our first multi-residential and we just thought, yeah, let's just sell them, de-risk. We know what our profit is.
Yep.
And that profit versus what the build cost is going to be, we're happy with that. On hindsight, we locked our profit in up front. So we sold out all 5. Unfortunately, between getting our final build quote 2 months later when we actually signed the build contract, that price in the contract had jumped 200 grand. So straight away, we'd lost 200 grand out of the feasibility.
Because the build went up by that 200.
Because the build went up by 200 and we've logged our profit in before we've even started building. These days, we sort of look at it in terms of if we can de-risk a little bit upfront, and a lot of private funders are not actually saying we need to see pre-sales. Obviously, you'll get a sharper rate if you do, but there's what we're seeing right now in the market is because they're hungry for business. And the market's good if you're in the right location, of course, is they're not actually saying you must have 2 sold or 3 sold, whereas a big bank, they will generally ask for that.
Yeah, because the risk is also if that build contract goes up too much and all of a sudden you don't hit that magic number of 15% or 20% profit on cost for that lender that you've engaged, all of a sudden you've got to start again for your finance. So it's a chicken and egg type scenario, isn't it?
Trying
to work out which way to go. So
100%. So luckily on that specific project at the tail end, when we were calling settlements, we had one buyer that had sort of bitten off more than he could chew and had bought up 3 or 4 projects off the plan. And we knew he wasn't going to be able to settle. So we offered him an out. No questions asked, no penalty, just look, let's just give the contract up. We'll take the property back and we'll relist it. And we managed to get another couple of $100,000 at the tail end, which kind of saved our bottom line. I mean, we would have walked away with about $100,000 and we managed to walk away with about $300,000. So it kind of helped us a hell of a lot.
It offsetted that construction cost.
Yeah.
And it's all about risk management, right? Like I'm looking at it and looking at the market at the moment and, you know, I'm bullish on the market again in the right areas, and it's like because I've been burnt in the past selling, right? I've got, like I said before, like this PTSD of like keeping, but at the same time it's about managing risk, right? Like you are de-risking selling off some off the plan, and moving forward, you know, you might go and say the ones that settled and might shoot, you know, if we didn't sell those 4, that's 4 times 200 on average. That's 800. We could have made 1.1 million. But again, no one has a crystal ball because it can go the other way, right? Like in GFC times, I know people that walked away from $300,000-$400,000 deposits because they couldn't settle on the property anyways because they bought something for 1.5 million off the plan and then it was valuing at 1.2 million. And they've put down, you know, deposits. You know, I had one person, they bought a $4 million property off the plan, $400,000 down, and it was valuing, you know, a lot less. So they literally just walked away from the deposit. That hasn't happened for a long time, but this is all about managing risk, right? And what we've got to be careful of in the development space and even just in business is that word greed, right? You can't be greedy because once you become greedy, it's not a good thing, right? And you're not thinking right. Like the way I look at it is if you have a feasibility, work off that feasibility as close as you can. If that feasibility was good enough for you then, it should be good enough for you now.
Yeah.
And that's the way I look at things.
And the other thing, there's nothing wrong with your end buyer having a little win as well and uplift when they settle, right? If they've got 200 grand extra equity in their property at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the chances that maybe they go, yeah, I like what these guys do. I'm going to buy again off them in the future because I know that there's profit to be made.
And let me tell you, selling off the plan sometimes is easier than the finished product, because selling off the plan, you don't see a lot of things. You see like the renders. You see these beautiful renders. You see, you know, and then when you're selling the actual finished product, people are walking through it now. They're touching, they're feeling it. They're going, that linen is actually very small. This bedroom, I can't even swing a cat in here, right? But when it's off the plan, you can't really see that as well. So there's, again, there's benefit and there's, you know, pros and cons to both selling off the plan and selling finished product at the same time.
Yeah. So what was your journey from there? I know you headed towards some duplexes up on the sunny coast. Can you kind of run us through that transition and how that looked and how those projects went?
Yep. And this probably extends from what Eric was saying earlier, was we went into that with a risk management mindset. So I'll probably group that little experience into one story. So we ended up purchasing three properties there, doing different things, mostly duplexes, one into two split, purchased around the same time. And it happened to be literally 2 months before the first interest rate rise back in 2022. So when we did our feasibility, we did it on the known factors. You know, the RBA had come out and said there will be no interest rate rises until 2024 on the record. Mm-hmm. And we were like, okay, so if we can get in and out of this in 18 months, we'll beat any interest rate rise. So we can sort of go, the market's probably right at its peak right now. We knew that going in. But we thought, look, it should stay stable. Even if there's a 10% pullback, we're still comfortable with the numbers. Where there'll still be some profit there. Little did we know there was 14, 15 interest rate rises pretty well back to back. So that basically just tanked the Sunshine Coast market, and especially for like duplexes. And, you know, looking at that now, our bank valuations at the start, then at the end, looking at what things are actually transacting for, that they've dropped more than 10%. So we'll lose money up there. That's just, you know, another lesson learned for us is like your best laid plans in risk management, you'll go into it. We pretty well hit our build time frame. The cost was pretty well bang on the money. Did everything we could in within our power, but we could not have forecast all of those interest rate rises, which is literally just, you know, eating away people's borrowing capacity. And that's really hurt the market there. Yeah. And lesson learned is like, we thought, you know, the Sunshine Coast market should stay fairly consistent. We did not factor in an ounce of growth. And I don't think you should ever do that in a FISO. If you do, awesome. But I would not be putting 10% increase based on a forecast that someone's come up with.
Yeah.
So exactly like you just said, completely out of your control. Inflation's creeping. The government pulls the only lever they can, which is push interest rates up.
Yep.
And that had a direct effect on your sales.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely. Couldn't have come at a worse time. And unfortunately, we built all throughout those rises. And then literally when we were put on the market, it was like, I think a month before, they'd just done their 14th increase. Yeah. And we're just like, you got to be kidding me.
but the story goes, you know, he could beat you down, but here he is again, right? Here they are again in Burleigh Heads and Coolangatta building, you know, beautiful luxury apartments now, which is I didn't even put two and two together with who you were before from Palm Beach to this one in Burleigh Heads,
yeah,
until Carson was like, I'm like, yeah, that's the same guy. So obviously these are one selling off a plan at the moment, you're in construction on the one in Burleigh Heads and you're working on one in Coolangatta. So I'm happy to chat about those. Not sure how far you want to go into detail on those, because obviously you are selling those off the plan and you probably want to hold your cards, I'm assuming, a bit close to your chest. Question I have for you is, why Burleigh Heads?
Burleigh Heads for us, I live in the area, love the area. I just think the market there has been consistently strong over the last, a long time, but especially the last 4 years. There's a huge demand from southern buyers, Brisbane buyers, local buyers. It's like a really good mix of buyers that are really got a, I guess, a magnifying glass on Burleigh. We're not beachfront. We're not in that space of that type of money, but we're sort of not far, sort of up on Burleigh Hill. And, you know, that area, I think it really has that village feel, a bit different to the beach. You're walkable to the beach, but you're right in amongst that sort of, you know, James Street precinct where it's got that village feel. You're elevated, so you get the breezes, you got the views, but you don't have the busyness of the beachfront. It feels more residential, more peaceful. Everything's sort of medium density or low rise, with the exception of a couple of buildings around us that were built, you know, in the 70s. But everything sort of, it feels more like a neighborhood rather than like a tourist destination.
So I'm fascinated, again, I asked a similar question earlier, but you're jumping into, you know, low rise development. How are you getting comfortable with those costs again? Because it's another jump, right? From townhouses and talking to a couple of builders, and then with the sales, when you're buying the site, you probably haven't got your renters. I'm assuming it wasn't a DA approved site. You run the DA yourself,
and it was impact assessable as well.
So how are you getting? Are you just using a square meter rate based off what agents' feedbacks are for the end sales, and then for the actual build, are you trying to find a like for like product that a builder's already built and you're trying to talk to them, or you're just using a square meter rate that someone's given you for your construction costs? Because, you know, when you're doing basements, it's a whole different game. So how did you get comfortable with that feasibility before you went, you know what, I'm going unconditional again?
And we bought that one at auction, so we didn't have a lot of negotiating power. We managed to get a 3-month settlement, which was good under auction terms. We managed to buy about $100,000 under what we were offered prior to auction. And we did try to get it prior to auction. So I'd recommend that there for anyone. If you're looking at things that are going to auction, if you can get there before. Look, a couple of ways that we did it. So we had another project very, very similar in Mermaid Beach that we'd costed up a bit smaller, but virtually the same. So basement, 4 levels, rooftop, just about 800, just probably about 800 square meters smaller, but virtually the identical thing. So we'd had that costed up by a builder. So we used that data that we had, but then we also went to another builder that's sort of a friendly, and he's ended up building it now. So he's more than just a friendly, he's actually building it for us. Went to him very, very early. So this is in our pre-due diligence phase. So we knew when it first hit the market to auction, we had a 60-day window.
Yeah.
We used that 60 days to do our due diligence because we knew come auction day, we had to make an unconditional offer. So we went to our architect, we went to our town planner, we went to our like engineer, we went to the builder, and we basically got mocked up floor plans of what we could actually put on the site. So we knew based on setbacks and height what we could get on there as a rough floor plate. Okay. Took that to the town planner and said, would council accept this? He said, yep, if you did this, this and this, we will need to lodge an impact assessable application, which is, you know, the highest type of assessment that we deal with. But there's a likelihood, there's precedent in the area that they would accept that. Then we went to the builder and said, very, very rough. You don't know what the finishes are. You don't know what the engineering is, but here's the total square meters. Can you put some science behind this in terms of a cost estimate? So he did that for us. We took that information based on what we thought we could sell them for. And there was some good direct comparable evidence that we could lean on based on square meter rates. And we grouped all that together and took that with us to the auction and said, this is the most we can pay for it. If it goes above here, we're walking. If we can get less than that, then it's you know, game on.
And then from the finance stand, did you have the cash or the deposit, or are you using investors again? And if you're using investors again, are you have you already got like a handshake agreement with them before you're going to auction, or how are you navigating that in the background?
So that one's a different structure. That one, we went in with a joint venture partner.
Yeah.
So we basically up front, and we've spent the best part of a year working through this, right? So it's not something that just happens overnight. Spent a year nurturing this relationship, going, if we find a site that meets these parameters and, you know, the debt levels around here, are you guys comfortable in tipping in the funds that's needed? So we had that agreement up front, clearly spelt out in writing. And we went to auction and we said, we can afford to pay this. We're going to need this amount of funding. They're like, yep, we can do that. And we can get it through to construction. So we had that clearly mapped out before we even stepped foot at the auction that day.
Now, I've seen the development. It's a beautiful development, by the way. Like, who was the architect?
Stuart Osmond.
Yeah, Stuart Osmond. So
Stuart's a legend.
Stuart's an absolute legend. He's designed a lot of my stuff. He's designing our stuff at the moment, actually. And he's a big customer of ours at MX Store, funny enough.
Okay.
He's one of the original OGs. He's a great guy. Talked to him, yesterday, actually, and we're getting on a call with him today. So what's the name of the development?
It's called Aspect Burley.
Aspect Burley. So for anyone that wants to have a look, I know, it's listed on realestate.com.au. Aspect Burley. Obviously, if you just type in Aspect Burley on Google, you'll find it as well.
It's got its own web page. It's on our Instagram page. So email development,
it better be top level on REA, because I know how much those project profiles cost. So make sure it's on the top of the page.
I think it's been up there a few months, so we're starting to get bumped.
Yeah. Got to ring that account manager and just get her to put it back up. But yeah, it's a beautiful development. And wish you all the best on that one, because you're setting precedent in that area as well, which is great. And we've got one in Burley, which will hopefully be amazing. So hopefully it helps us. Hopefully it helps us all. And you have another, again, going to the next level, and you've got another, and that one's about $19-20 million in Burley Heads overall value, and then you have another one that's about $30 million. In Coolangatta.
Yep.
So you just don't mess around, eh? You're not scared. You got big
boots. I fear like everyone. And
you're walking around with a wheelbarrow, aren't you?
Yeah. Exactly. Some days it's heavier than others.
No, that's awesome. Yeah. So what are you doing there?
So we're doing 8 units, single level units, over 9 levels. So it's almost like Burley times 2.
Yeah.
So we've got sort of a bit of a model there that we become comfortable with over the last probably two and a half years, from our experience at Mermaid Beach into Burley, then into Coolangatta. So just one street back from the beach in Rainbow Bay, which is, you know, there's a lot going on there. So we're pretty bullish on that area and on the project overall.
I remember, this is going back probably about 16 years ago now, selling shower screens and wardrobes, you know, knocking on doors. And I did a project there for a builder called Parkview. They're based in New South Wales, a big builder developer. And it was on Eden there as well. And this is like one of the first ones, you know, multi-story. It was the same type of thing. And it's just amazing to see how much development has happened in that area, that Coolangatta, Kira, the whole southern end of the Gold Coast. Now, when you drive down there, the restaurants, that whole saying, you know, if you build it, they will come, is so true. And we're not talking about $1 million units. We're not talking about $2 million units. We're talking about $10 million units. You know, like when you think of the caliber of people that are buying a $10 million unit to live in, right? Plus body corporate and rates and all the rest of it. That's the caliber of people that are coming to the area. And I'm a big believer on the Gold Coast, and I've been here now since 2007, and I've seen it grow so much. And, you know, it's known as the boom and bust town, but let me tell you, in my opinion, it has changed, right? There's a lot of infrastructure being spent here at the moment, and there's just a different level of money here. There's a different caliber of person that is now living on the Gold Coast. Before it was just, let's build these high rises, let's holiday let them, their investments. And the first thing you sell when the market gets tough is your holiday unit. Well, these people are now, you know, moving in from interstate, internationally, and calling Gold Coast home. And Carson was at a development seminar last week, which last minute you bailed on, and I was second choice in line. And I couldn't make it because it was the next day, and they were, you know, highly regarded economists, property economists, were even talking about Gold Coast and how in future it's going to be a playground for, you know, the wealthy, you know, because of lifestyle and how we're restricted on land. And these are all the things that anyone listening has to look for when they're looking at developing in real estate, right? There's macro markets and then there's micro markets. And for me, I concentrate solely and wholly on the Gold Coast because I know the market and I'm confident in the market. And for anyone here, Shannon and Carson, a little bit different, right? Because they're in land and it's hard to get land. So if they just look in the Gold Coast, they're not going to find much, right? So they got to start looking at other areas. So they are forced, right, to become experts in multiple different areas. So what I would recommend doing, depending on what you're looking for, if you're looking for a small scale residential, like you started, right, with one house and a duplex and then slowly getting into to bigger projects, I would become an expert in an area myself personally. If you're looking at getting into land, like Shannon and Carson, you have no choice but to look at outside areas. So you need to be very, very, very well-rounded in regards to, you know, what the market's doing in these other micro markets, supply and demand, and these types of things, which is very important. So again, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. Like, going from 20 grand to 500 grand and 300 grand, and now you're talking, you know, into the tens of millions of dollars in GR, and I can see it, like, very, very clear to me. I'd love to get you back on the podcast in a little while once a couple of these projects are finished so we can unpack these other stories so we can actually see these hundreds of thousands turn into millions, which I'm assuming is going to happen moving forward. So I just want to say thank you. I know you have a relationship with Shannon and Carson, and anyone that they're connected with. We love having on and sharing your story.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate you having me on here. And it's not always easy, but I think if you have a clear vision and a purpose of where you're wanting to go, and persistence, I mean, that for me is the number one thing, because you're going to be riding good markets, bad markets, sideways markets. So yeah. I think you've just got to hang in there. If this is what you want to do, that's I guess what I could leave you with today.
It's having that tenacity, you know. And I say this a lot, knowing who you are and who you're not and what you can actually handle, right? Because we all need to sleep at night.
Yeah.
And you need to make sure, right, the size of your wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
Right? And you're comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Because this game isn't for the faint-hearted. Everyone thinks, you know, the property development space is the space where everybody's making millions, like yourself. But the reality is most of your money is just put into the next project. I'm sure you're not living a very lavish out there lifestyle, spending millions of dollars, because the reality, it's all going back into the next project.
100%.
What happens, 4 turns into 9, turns into 18. And next thing you know, what once was your boundaries and guidelines, all of a sudden is not that anymore. And you're bidding at auction and all of a sudden you're doing 50.
Yeah.
And that's just the reality, because as humans, we just want to keep pushing and pushing.
But I had the same fear at 1,
yeah,
as I do now at like 8 or 9, and I imagine at say 15.
Yeah,
it's like a muscle, and it's like if you stretch it or you push it, it grows. So it's really growing that level of comfortability. And some people might go, that's not for me, and that's absolutely fine.
Yeah,
for me, it's like I've had that drive to keep growing, keep learning, and I don't see myself doing super big stuff, but I think within this zone, yeah, we've pushed ourselves quite a lot. But that's taken time, and that's taken continued work on myself as well. I think if you work on yourself, that's probably the number one thing, because you're going to be the make or break of whether you succeed or not in the long term.
I agree. What's the best way of, if somebody wants to get in contact with you or know a little bit more about New Mill Developments, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
Yeah, so we're on socials. Don't have a massive following yet, but maybe after today it grows a bit.
And it's New Mill. It's N-E-W-M-I-L, one L.
Yeah, underscore developments.
Yep.
That's on Instagram. We've got a web page, Facebook.
Yeah.
And then obviously our project. Yes. Websites as well. Yeah. So
make sure to check out Aspect Burley. If anyone wants to purchase a luxury unit in the heart of Burley Heads, it's a beautiful project. Make sure you check it out and share it around. Definitely. Yeah.
And Solace Rainbow Bay coming soon.
There you go.
Solace. You got the hot tip.
S-O-L-A-C-E. Is that
S-O-L-A-C-E? Yes.
Solace. Awesome. Again, guys, thank you very much for paying attention to us. We know that your attention is scarce and there's a lot of podcasts out there that you guys could be watching, and we appreciate all the support. Make sure you comment, like, subscribe. What did you enjoy? What didn't you enjoy? And ask some questions in the comments, because I know that we don't get around to every single question, and hopefully we can answer those questions as well. And thank you again, and we'll see you on the next one.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.